Good morning, Council, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 6, 2024, and we are on the third case of our three-case oral argument calendar today. A couple of housekeeping points. I know some of you have heard these from the first argument, but in case not, there is a switch on the front of the podium you can use to raise it to your comfort level. Appellant will have 15 minutes for opening argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Respondent will have 15 minutes. The proceedings are being recorded and live streamed on Zoom. The audio recording will be available on our website within about 24 hours. That's the only recording that should be made of today's proceeding. When you begin your argument, please identify yourself for the record and the party you represent, and let us know how you'd like us to refer to you. With that, counsel, the next case is A23-1580, St. Paul Building, LLC, respondent, and versus Commonwealth Properties Incorporated, defendant, John Rupp, appellant. And counsel, whenever you're ready to proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jack Pierce. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, John Rupp, and I can be referred to as Mr. Pierce. The general rule in Minnesota for years has been that a shareholder is not liable for the debts of a corporation in which the shareholder has an interest. There is an exception to that rule that is to be used in very limited circumstances. And those limited circumstances are set forth in the seminal case of Victoria Elevator. Victoria Elevator has two separate prongs, each of which must be satisfied. And what I want to start my argument is in focusing on the second factor. And that's the injustice and unfairness. There is no dispute, or there's been no argument made, that Mr. Rupp engaged in a constructive fraud. So in order for the second prong to have been met, there must be some element of injustice or unfairness. Now, what that injustice or unfairness cannot be is the inability to collect a debt. Repleting case law, that does not equate to injustice or unfairness.
Can I ask you, though, so looking at some of the cases that you relied on, like Groves versus Dakota Printing Services, I take the point that this was a transaction between St. Paul Building and Commonwealth, and that the issue of personal guarantee wasn't used as a false assurance to get the transaction to go forward. But when I look at a case like Groves, there's no element of withdrawing, the shareholder withdrawing from the business as the, withdrawing from assets from the corporation as litigation is occurring. And that seems pretty unique to this context, and I think I'd like you to address, I've seen the framing of prong one and prong two. Obviously, prong one includes siphoning assets. Prong two doesn't explicitly, but more broadly refers to, resulting injustice or unfairness. So why isn't it proper to consider the fact that in this case we have Commonwealth not paying rent from June 2019 until its eviction in February 2020. There's a complaint filed in July 2020, and after that point, wind down begins in September of 2021. Assets are being withdrawn during that period of time by Mr. Rupp. And then the settlement occurs in October, and then we end up where we are now. Why wouldn't that be considered distinct from these other cases like Groves that don't have any element of that sort of removal of assets while there's ongoing litigation?
First, I'd like to disagree with two factual premises contained within the question. The first factual premise that I would disagree with is that somehow Mr. Rupp engaged in something nefarious in not executing the personal guarantee.
I'm not presuming that.
Okay. The fact that he did not sign a personal guarantee is not his fault. That's the respondent's fault for not asking for one, for
no,
not requesting.
I think that works in your favor, yeah. My view at this point in time. It's not used as it was in the Weppy case or Webby case in order to allay concerns and get the deal to go forward.
Exactly.
But what I'm more interested is in what happens once the litigation is ongoing and, for example, Aston Martin, other cars are being taken out of the name of the business when there's this judgment looming.
Well, for one, those cars were not paid for by the business.
But that doesn't matter. The title for those cars was in the name of Commonwealth, correct?
They weren't in the name of Commonwealth.
So if Commonwealth has title to them, Commonwealth owns them, and Commonwealth can sell them and do whatever it wants with those, correct?
It can. And had the respondent brought a claim for a fraudulent transfer violation, that would be relevant.
But I think the point is that if I'm, you know, I don't mean to put words in Judge Eade's mouth, but I think his point is, my concern is, Commonwealth had some assets at the time of litigation, knowing that there was a $443,000 judgment against it, and yet is transferring assets out of Commonwealth when it could have used those assets to pay off the judgment.
I would ask the court to look at the Association of Mill and Elevator case. In that case, the shareholder used corporate assets to pay down a debt for which the shareholder was personally guaranteed. It was a personal liability. He used assets to pay down that debt instead of paying down other trade vendors who were unsecured.
It's different. I mean, this was like the, I mean, some of the cars Mr. Rupp just gave away to people, and you know, the, or he asked his wife to take title back to one of the cars. I mean, this wasn't, there was one debt, in, I think, that was identified that, you know, there was an exchange for, but I don't think that that applied to all of the assets that were taken out of Commonwealth.
There was a debt that a vehicle was paid for. There were vehicles that, although they were titled for insurance purposes in Commonwealth's name, they were not listed on Commonwealth's tax returns.
Well, it doesn't matter what reason they were titled for. If title is in a company's name, that the company owns it.
Respectfully, it does matter, because the issue for the second prong is, where's the injustice or unfairness outside of being unable to collect a debt?
Well, the unfairness is that the company had assets and now they don't have assets anymore.
And that would, again, perhaps support a fraudulent transfer claim under the Minnesota Uniform Fraudulent Transfer Act. That's not the claim that's before the court.
Why couldn't an equitable remedy like piercing the corporate veil encompass that same issue? What prevents the district court from using that equitable remedy here to get to the same result?
Because I don't think there's any law that I'm aware of that supports, on the second prong, we're not talking about the first prong, we're talking about the second prong, which that is the relationship between the corporation and the plaintiff.
Well, it's not just a matter of the relationship between the corporation and the plaintiff. It goes to the injustice that may have occurred.
And if injustice is inability to collect a debt, then the second prong is always satisfied.
Not necessarily. But it seems like, you know, there's also the Guava case that had been cited too, which is non-precedential, so it's not binding on us. It's only of persuasive value. But the facts in that case seem to be strikingly similar to this case in terms of what had occurred.
I would posit that the actions of Paul Hansmeier and what he did in Guava has nothing remotely similar to what Mr. Rupp did. If you review the Guava case, Mr. Hansmeier has a long history before this court, a long history before the Supreme Court. He was representing a company. He was representing someone who had sanctions issued against his law firm. He then transferred $150,000 out.
So during the while the litigation was pending, it appears that there's assets and employees that were transferred from Commonwealth to the University Club, correct?
While Commonwealth was winding down, yes, similar to Snyder.
And this is while the litigation was going on, correct? This litigation here?
I believe the litigation was, yeah, because it was after the pandemic. It was after the litigation. I can't remember the exact date of the complaint, but I believe the winding down happened in 2020 and 2021 after the PPP funds run out, and then employees were transferred.
So there were PPP funds that came in to Commonwealth at least twice, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
And then there were assets that were transferred to the University Club while the litigation was pending, including employees and assets. What were those assets that were transferred?
I don't believe there were any assets that were transferred to the University Club. I believe there were employees that switched, which stands to reason if a business is winding down and you own multiple businesses, which is exactly the case in Snyder, which I think Snyder is, to talk about a case that is factually on point with this case.
So in 2019, the gross receipts, it appears that according to your reply brief, there were gross receipts in 2019 in Commonwealth of $950,000.
That's what the tax returns show, yes, sir.
Okay, so that's 2019.
Yeah.
Where did those assets, because I thought the testimony from Mr. Rupp was that he only put cash into Commonwealth when it needed cash to pay certain debts.
The way the tax return works, the income, and because if you look at the tax returns, there's a loan to shareholder on Schedule L of both tax returns. And so the receipts that are coming in are the funds from Mr. Rupp.
Okay, where were those receipts documented for those alleged loans that Mr. Rupp provided to Commonwealth?
On the tax returns. Schedule L shows a loan to shareholder.
Was there any documentation?
Other than on the tax returns, none that's in the record, and I don't believe that any would be necessarily required. There's nothing that I know of, and this goes to factor one, not factor two, that says in order for corporate formalities to be observed, that if there's a loan to shareholder, there needs to be a promissory note with terms. The concept of corporate formalities in factor one is, are you acting as a corporation? Are you maintaining tax returns? Are you maintaining various bank accounts? Are you commingling funds that, you know, if you were commingling funds, if you were putting funds in from one company to another and not documenting them in any way soever.
Right, so, and I'm glad you raised that point, because that seems to be what's happening here. Mr. Rupp is getting money from the other companies, 10 to 20 companies that he has. Then he takes money, then he writes a check to Commonwealth. Commonwealth then provides services such as bookkeepers, controllers, et cetera, to the other companies, but there's no bill. There's nothing documenting those expenses that are provided to the other companies, those bookkeeping services, those controller services, et cetera, et cetera. So all of these things are happening, but there's no documentation of those services being provided and what the value is of those services. So all we have is basically passed through Mr. Rupp. Why? That just seems to be the kind of the classic, okay, it's an alter ego of the other.
I would respectfully disagree in the sense that Snyder, that man had three different businesses. He had employees that were going back and forth. They all shared the same office space. And the Supreme Court in Snyder held that was not enough to pierce the corporate veil.
But in Snyder, the court specifically noted that there was no siphoning of assets, because siphoning of assets doesn't occur if the transactions are for fair consideration, as appeared to be the case in Snyder. And we have, you know, again, going back to the cars, a number of these transactions where the cars were being moved out of the business at a time when Commonwealth was in financial trouble. And Victoria Elevator itself notes that, you know, the defendant withdrew funds, allegedly as wages, from the corporation at a time that the corporation was in financial trouble. Why isn't this exactly the same as a seminal case on this issue?
It's not exactly the same for a number of reasons. The first reason would be, if you're siphoning an asset of the company, in theory or in practice, that would be an asset that was paid for and bought for by the company. True, it's been titled, but what is the value that you're taking from the company? You're not taking any value for the company, because the company didn't buy the asset. So what is being siphoned? What is being taken away from the company? Nothing that the company bought.
It doesn't matter if it bought it. It has title. That's all you need with a car is title. That's it.
But
it doesn't matter who paid for it. It doesn't matter who drives it. It doesn't matter who claims that they own it. Ownership is with the title. That's all important with cars.
If you're going to siphon an asset, there has to be something that you're taking away from the corporation.
Right, and the corporation has title. So the corporation can sell those cars and get income, can get value for those cars, right?
Yes, but even
so,
if...
So then why isn't that siphoning off by the title while the litigation is pending and while Commonwealth has debt that it has a judgment hanging over its head? Why shouldn't those be sold off to pay off that judgment?
Couple of answers to that question. One, if a company transferring an asset every time it has a judgment against it equates to siphoning, then again.
Well, it's not if the asset's transferred for fair consideration, right?
Because
and
then the company
that
has
is a question
that, because then the fair consideration goes into the company, and so there's money to be collected.
And that was a question that was not decided by the district court. The district court, in its opinion, does not discuss whether or not assets were siphoned off or not.
Well, I think it did. It said, since John Rupp has assets, including some that were transferred for Commonwealth to himself and or other associates and entities during this litigation, it is unfair to allow him to avoid payment to plaintiff of the judgment.
Exactly. The district court was focused on collection. That's the district court was focused.
No, the district court talks about it being unfair, and that's one of the factors you can look at under the second prong under Victoria.
But you can't look at whether or not a judgment creditor has the ability to collect or not. It has to be some fundamental unfairness more than just an inability to collect.
Right, and that's why in a lot of the cases you've cited, if a business just fails, a real estate venture, an investment in a business just fails, the court has held on prong two, or courts have held on prong two, that doesn't pass muster because there's no showing of injustice or fundamental unfairness. But this is not just the Commonwealth failed. I mean, the allegations here are that Commonwealth failed, and then as it was failing, valuable assets were being taken out without fair consideration. So I guess my question for you is, isn't there some tension between what you are arguing in terms of, Mr. Rupp bought those cars, put them into the title of Commonwealth, and so they weren't purchased by Commonwealth. And then your argument about undercapitalization and that, we shouldn't be concerned about that because Mr. Rupp was funding Commonwealth from the beginning. That's how Commonwealth was built out. I mean, it can't be, or maybe you can address this, that every time a business is underfunded, that we can't consider then taking assets out at the time that the business is winding down towards unfairness, can it?
I see my time has expired, Mayor.
Go ahead.
There's two different separate factors in prong one. I think Your Honor's question addresses. One is initial capitalization, which here is to be determined in 1985. It's at the time of, and then the second is sort of an insolvency question, is what I'm sort of hearing. And the insolvency question is also to be determined at the time that the lease was entered into. Insolvency, if you look at the tax returns for 2017 and 2019 in particular, which relates to the year 2018 when the lease was signed, the assets equal the liabilities. So the company was not insolvent. And so I see that my time has expired. And I thank the court for its
Could
time.
Could I ask a couple of questions on the first issue?
Please.
My first question is, did you properly raise the first issue before the district court by putting it in a footnote? Because it appears to me that the district court didn't actually decide the first issue that you raise in your brief.
I do believe it was properly before the court, Your Honor. The initial motion was brought under Rule 52. Okay, that was the initial notice of motion under Rule 52. And that was addressed in the first round of briefing. And in the second round of briefing.
Did you appeal that order?
It was not an appealable order. In fact, there was no order based on that. In fact, what the district court.
Have you challenged that order now on appeal?
No, that order has not been challenged on appeal. And that was because that was a motion that involved Commonwealth. Thereafter, what the district court decided to do was allow the respondent to bring a motion to not only add a party, but to enter judgment against that party at the same time.
So then didn't you have an obligation at that point to raise an argument that procedure was improper?
I believe the argument was raised in the footnote in the brief. I believe that sufficiently preserved the issue for appeal.
Okay.
In the footnote to the brief to the district court?
Yes.
Okay. And that footnote just references
that I don't have it memorized, but the footnote references that the procedure by which is being employed to enter a judgment against somebody on a motion is improper.
But the district court did not decide that issue.
It's sort of inferred. The district court referred to the Johns v. Harbridge case in its opinion, and Johns dealt with Rule 15 and whether or not it's proper to amend a complaint after judgment had been entered. And then in Johns, there was a Rule 56 motion. In all the cases that were cited by the respondent, there was either a Rule 56 motion, there was a trial and a Rule 52 motion. In all of those cases, except for the one involving Mr. Hansmeier, in all of those cases, the party to whom judgment was entered as a shareholder was a party to the action, was brought in as a party, as a formal party. That did not occur here.
So, what are your thoughts on whether or not we shouldn't just consider this under Rule 61 harmless error? Because, say the matter was presented under Rule 1501, the district court has the power to grant the amendment to the pleading, to the complaint, as justice may require, I think is the language, and is encouraged to freely grant, as justice may require, leave to amend. So why wouldn't this just be harmless error that the procedure operated this way? I mean, what would have been different, and where is the prejudice to Mr. Rupp that the court adjudicated the unjust enrichment remedy or claim in this manner?
Because when leave is granted to amend a complaint pursuant to Rule 1501, that gives the party an opportunity to review the amended complaint and respond. Can it be a 1202F motion? Could it be a motion to dismiss? Could it be us bringing a motion for summary judgment? It then defines what the standard
might
is going.
Might Mr. Rupp have wanted to go to trial on this case, for example?
For example. It provides all of those due
process. How would the trial have looked differently than the proceeding was before the district court as it stands?
I mean, because then the district court would have had an opportunity to address credibility, for example.
I mean, there was discovery that was
Completed
with regard to the specific issue.
Which sort of begs the question then. The question being, what was the standard that the district court employed? If it was the standard under Rule 15, then the respondent would be allowed to amend the complaint. I am unaware of any case that says.
In which case, Mr. Rupp could have filed a motion to dismiss, and we would be here on a de novo standard of review rather than on a discretion standard of review.
Or clear and convincing error if it was a Rule 52, or summary judgment standard under Rule 56.
Well, we would only be here on a de novo standard review if you prevailed and he appealed, right?
Correct.
I mean, you wouldn't be able to appeal from a denial of the motion to dismiss.
No, I typically would not do that. But it would have allowed Mr. Rupp those procedural safeguards provided by the Rules of Civil Procedure. Because again, I don't know what Rule of Civil Procedure, what is the process, what is the mechanism by which judgment was entered. Typically it's a complaint, and then there's an answer, or a motion to dismiss, and then a summary judgment. What is the process that was employed? It was a motion. I have never heard of a motion in and of itself, without a person being named a party, being both a motion to add someone as a party and at the same time enter judgment. Thank you,
Your
Honor.
I have two more questions.
Okay.
In Guava, we relied heavily on the legislature's decision to grant the district court broad equitable remedies under the LLC statute. I know that that's been amended, but the corporation statute was an analogy to the LLC statute, so I said, I wonder if that's still in the corporation statute, which it is, which is at MnStat 302A751, which says broadly that the district court has the ability to impose equitable remedies at judgment. Why can't we, like in Guava, determine that the district court did have statutory authority to create this outside process? Because I do think that in Guava, where the court was finding the authority was from the statute. And I do think that that does appear in the corporation statute, and here we are talking about a corporation.
302A751, if my memory serves,
yep,
deals with issues between shareholders and the ability of a court to fashion a remedy among dissenting shareholders or in a breakup. 302A751 hasn't been brought up anywhere before, so I'm just going on what my old mind thinks it says. But 751 is in the remedy section when there's a dissenting shareholder. And so the district court, in addressing and fashioning a remedy for when there is a dissenting shareholder or one shareholder alleges oppressive conduct against another, then the district court has brought equitable remedies. I do not believe 751 applies outside.
So I should just be fair. So it does say in an action by a creditor when the claim of the creditor has been reduced to a judgment and an execution thereon has been returned unsatisfied.
And again, I'm assuming that the statute then applies to a remedy as with respect to the company. I don't know if it's 751 speaks to a remedy as to a shareholder. I do know that 751, at least in all the cases that I have seen, is not cited as a basis upon which to impose liability upon a shareholder in favor of a judgment creditor.
Well, and I assume that you would also probably disagree with this court's decision in Guava that the LLC statute, which was substantially the same, conferred this kind of authority. I assume that you would also just think that analysis was incorrect.
I would think it's incorrect, and I would also harken back to the players involved in Guava. Mr. Hansmeier's conduct in that litigation and the conduct that got him to that point is far different and is an outlier, thank goodness. And I think because of that case and the facts and the circumstances and that it's unpublished, I don't think it has any applicability to the actions or lack thereof of Mr. Rupp.
And then my last question, I apologize for going long, but do you agree with the respondent that to the extent we would follow Guava, that your client received the same amount of process that the district court gave in the Guava case?
I think the process was similar that Mr. Rupp received, that Mr. Hansmeier received in Guava.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. Excuse me. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Richard Landon on the behalf of respondent and judgment creditor, St. Paul Building, LLC. Appellant John Rupp has raised two arguments on appeal, one procedural and one on the merits. I actually want to start with the procedural issue that the most recent questions were addressing. This is appellant's argument that the court had no authority to amend the judgment when it did. We do believe that this was waived below when Rupp failed to address it at the second hearing on the veil-piercing motion. And appellant inexplicably didn't even address this argument in the reply brief. But even if the court considers the argument, we think it's clear that a trial court retains jurisdiction to take actions to enforce a judgment. That general proposition is not in dispute.
But why doesn't the appellant propose a better rule, which is that you should file a motion under Rule 15 to actually add the person to this case before you actually get to evaluating piercing the corporate veil? Because it does seem to me that Mr. Rupp is deprived of the benefits of our normal rules of the game when the district court comes in after judgment to a person who's not listed in the pleadings and is imposing a judgment against them.
I have two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is that it's unique to the issue of veil piercing under the alter ego theory, because the alter ego theory is based on the premise that a sole owner of a corporation has not treated the corporation as a separate entity, and therefore the law should treat them as the same.
But isn't there something that should be concerning to us, that Mr. Rupp was never served with a complaint individually in this case, and he was never listed in the complaint individually?
Well, Your Honor, specifically to that point, veil piercing is an equitable remedy. It is not a cause of action.
But you normally would allege it in your complaint, right? I mean, the normal way that veil piercing happens in terms of the rules of civil procedure is that you would include the person who you think the veil should be pierced. You'd bring the claims against, the company and the person individually, and then you would dispute through motion practice whether or not you could pierce the corporate veil.
No, Your Honor. If the only claim at issue against Mr. Rupp was veil piercing, I would expect that he would
in a normal case. So not this case where sort of after judgment you're realizing some things have happened and veil piercing might be required. In a normal case where you are wanting to allege an alter ego theory, you would put that into your complaint and you would serve the complaint on the person individually. Right?
You certainly could, Your Honor. I don't think that there's any authority that says you have to do that. And again, when the only issue is veil piercing itself, that is an equitable remedy, not a cause of action. And so there would be no claim against the individual. There would be no legal basis for them to be named as a defendant if the only issue is veil piercing.
But the Supreme Court has treated it as a claim. In one of the cases that the district court cited, Barton v. Moore, came up on appeal from a Rule 56 motion on the plaintiff's cause of action, their claim that was essentially veil piercing. And so, I think, one of my concerns is the due process that Judge Larson raises here that was not afforded to Mr. Rupp because he was not added as a party ever. And I just that gives me pause in thinking that this would be some sort of harmless error, assuming we don't agree with your waiver argument. So maybe you can address in particular, I think there's some appeal to your concept that this isn't really a theory of liability, but rather the remedy, because Commonwealth is the one that's liable for the claim. Correct. So maybe you can speak more to why this isn't prejudicial to Mr. Rupp that the district court proceeded in this manner.
Sure. Two responses, Your Honor. First, very quickly, we cite cases in our brief that did dismiss veil-piercing claims because they were not a cause of action. I think that the law...
Federal cases.
They are federal cases.
That they didn't cite Minnesota law in any of them.
Well, we did cite to a District of Minnesota case that was applying that in under Minnesota
District
law.
Court of
yes,
Minnesota.
Correct. To the second point, the prejudice issue, the point that we've raised in our brief is that Mr. Rupp has never explained what more process was due, right? When this
well,
motion
I think
he's
was- arguing you should have filed it under Rule 15. And if you file it under Rule 15, then depending upon how well you plead your claim in the complaint, he could potentially be able to file a motion to dismiss because you didn't plead adequate information. I mean, I think that's what he's saying his harm is that once you start this process over by having the actual pleading, then all of the rules of the game with respect to the rules of civil procedure come into play. And I don't think that you can say depriving a person of the ability to use the rules of civil procedure to hold your client to their, you know, burden of pleading, burden of production, that there is no harm there.
Well, but again, any argument that he would have had to dismiss a complaint, he certainly could have raised that at the hearing in August 2023. This motion was first heard in January 2023, and opposing counsel represented Commonwealth and made the same due process arguments before the court at that time, said that there could be no relief here when Mr. Rupp had not even been served personally. And so the court said, okay, I will hold this in abeyance. I will order that you must personally serve Mr. Rupp.
With a motion, but not with a complaint. So you've never made him a party to this action.
Well, but again, I'm not sure how
and this
stating
comes
this
back
in a complaint.
To appellant's argument about it's not clear what our standard is in reviewing the district court's decision to decide this motion. We review for abuse of discretion whether to pierce the corporate veil, but what's our standard of review of this type of motion that isn't coming from our rules of civil procedure, which is where we would normally figure out what our proper standard of review is.
Well, as I said, veil piercing is an equitable remedy, and I've never seen any authority that suggests the court's decision to rule on a veil piercing motion is reviewed for anything other than abuse of discretion.
Are you arguing that the district court's order essentially answers the question of whether or not the claim would have survived if added to the complaint, because the district court is implicitly finding that as a matter of law, this is a valid claim for veil piercing, I mean, by its order. And so it answers the Rule 12 question by the nature in which the district court addressed the Victoria elevator factors and prongs 1 and 2. Is that your argument?
Well, no, my argument, Your Honor, is that if there were any legal argument for why veil piercing were not a valid theory to be applied procedurally, I think that could have been raised in Mr. Rupp's opposition brief or at the hearing in August 2023. Mr. Rupp did not raise any of those arguments. He did not tell the court, look, we need more procedure so I can raise these arguments, so I can do X, so I can do Y. He did not ask for an evidentiary hearing where he could testify in person. He certainly could have. He had the opportunity to. He told the court that he wanted to conduct discovery. And so the court allowed him to conduct discovery. He submitted that discovery in opposition to the motion. In terms of going back to the harmless error question, it's not clear what more Mr. Rupp thinks he should have been allowed to do, what other arguments could have been raised. Your point about the motion to dismiss is, you know, goes to my concern about veil piercing not being a cause of action. It is an equitable remedy. The arguments against veil piercing are the same for Commonwealth, the party to the lawsuit, and Mr. Rupp, the sole shareholder, the alter ego.
Can I pause you and turn you to prong two of Victoria elevator? Because I'm a little concerned about, you know, the way it, the rule is framed in White v. Jorgensen, this 1982 case. It, you know, describes prong one, focusing on the shareholder's relationship to the corporation, then sets forth the eight factors, including siphoning of funds. And then it describes prong two in the terms that your counterpart is urging us to focus on, I think, which is that the test examines the relationship of the plaintiff to the corporation. It requires a showing of an element of injustice or fundamental unfairness. And there's no, you know, that in combination with other law saying that, you know, failure to satisfy a debt isn't the, you know, the question that's addressed at prong two, gives me pause that considering, as the district court did, that Mr. Rupp took assets out of the business to satisfy, while the business was failing and while the judgment was pending and the litigation was pending, is not an appropriate analysis at prong two, and that's really a prong one question. Can you respond to that?
Sure, Your Honor. My response is that while I'm aware that the White case uses that language describing the relationship of the parties, I'm not aware of any authority that has looked at a district court's decision to pierce the corporate veil and say that was based on an inappropriate consideration of the improper relationships, right? I've never seen a court use that language from White to describe an abuse of discretion by a district court. What the court found in this case was that the second prong was met because appellant had used the corporate form to gain an advantage that he did not deserve. And that's the same language that this court has used in affirming veil piercing in the Guava case, in the FKS Enterprises versus Webby case. And so I don't think there's anything inappropriate with the court's description of why the second prong was met.
But Webby is, what is your response to the reply brief, which I think effectively points out that in Webby, the issue of the personal guarantee was used up front at the beginning of the transaction, where the defendant in that case was assuring the plaintiff that there was no need for a personal guarantee, that he was going to make sure that the deal went through, and that just simply was false. How do you respond in this case? There's no showing that Mr. Rupp did that. The personal guarantee clause was crossed out. No one followed up on it. It has all the looks of an arm's length transaction between two businesses. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, my first response is that I've never seen any authority that suggests that a failure to get a personal guarantee is somehow a bar to veil piercing. I've seen no case. Mr. Pierce has not cited any case.
But it's a deficiency in the analogy between Webby and this case, you would agree?
Well, it is a difference between the Webby case and this case, although there are many similarities. That also was a case about a transaction where two parties were entering into a transaction, and Mr. Webby, on appeal or in defense against the veil piercing, was arguing that, well, you should have known that the corporation you were entering a contract with had no assets because it was just an investment vehicle. Right, you should have. There's no injustice because you should have known that it had no money, and I told you I wasn't going to put my money on the line. That was his argument as to why veil piercing was not appropriate.
In addition to, he was assuring them that don't worry, I'm good for the money on the front end, and that there's no evidence that Mr. Rupp did this here. You know.
Well, I certainly agree that there's not the same kind of fraudulent misrepresentation that Mr. Webby was responsible for in the FKS Enterprises case. However, I do think that Mr. Rupp was presenting Commonwealth as a business that could stand on its own and would stand on its own for its own debts, whereas what my client did not know at the time, there's no evidence that it knew or had reason to know, was that it was really just a facade, that it was not able to cover any debts other than what Mr. Rupp personally decided he wanted to address. I think that is...
In other words, your client didn't have any reason to know that the corporation didn't have its own separate income stream.
Correct.
And that at the time that they entered into this contract, it would have been reasonable for your client to believe that the corporation had its own income stream, had its own ability to make money, and that those decisions weren't solely decided by the one shareholder what money came in or out of the corporation.
Correct. And Your Honors, we were shocked to find in discovery that I've never seen a situation like this where a company has operated for 35 years with literally no source of independent income. It didn't generate any revenue. It was performing services for other companies absolutely for free, did not get reimbursed for it at all, and that was by design. That was Mr. Rupp's design for the company, and that's what the district court noted in going through the prong one factors, that this was a company that was designed to be insolvent if Mr. Rupp didn't want to pay any debts that the company owed.
So the company, Commonwealth, and that's the company we're talking about, under the lease agreement, they were leasing two floors in the building, correct?
I believe that's correct. I'm not sure the space.
Okay, and then I want to go to the assets. Mm-hmm. So when I saw something, and I think in your briefing, you'd mentioned that some assets and employees were transferred from Commonwealth to the University Club. What were those assets?
I believe that was a reference to essentially office property. I don't know that there's a detailed list of what those assets were, but the point was that the property that Commonwealth had and was using in its business were then moved over to his other businesses. There's no value in the record attached to those assets, but it was clear that as Commonwealth was winding down, the idea was, well, it's working for these other businesses, so let's just move everything over to the other businesses. I see my time is up, but if you have any other questions,
may I ask another question?
Yes. Yeah,
thank you. So a follow-up on that, other than, well, it appears that a number of cars were transferred from Commonwealth while the litigation was going on. Were there any other assets or cash that Commonwealth had from the time that it had been put on notice that there was some litigation pending until the time of the judgment?
I'm not aware of other significant assets, Your Honor. I mean, again, Commonwealth was designed, according to Mr. Rupp, it was designed to not have any assets, and the idea was that it never would have assets. And, you know, we think that the cars are a perfect example of why that was really just a facade. Mr. Rupp says, well, they never actually belonged to the company. I was just using them in the company's name because I could get a better deal on my insurance, right? That's exactly what the facade factor looks at. Unless the court has any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel says that this is an equitable remedy and not a cause of action. That merely begs the question in the sense that the remedy is a judgment in the amount of $450,000 against Mr. Rupp. There has to be, and in any lawsuit, there is a remedy. As we're taught in law school, you have facts for liability, then you have damages. Your damages are the remedy that you're going to get. And in the cases that are cited by the respondent, all of them involve a civil rule of civil procedure other than Guava, all the published decisions. Johns 15.01. If you look at Kelbrow deals with 15.02, and Rule 15.02 deals with a motion to amend to conform to the evidence after a trial is done, which is kind of what this is, but it isn't, without the benefit of a trial. Equity Trust, the findings were reviewed under Rule 52. Malberg, the parties in the original action, and there was a trial. Almack, reviewed under Rule 52.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, do you have any authority that stands for the proposition that piercing the corporate veil needs to be pled as a cause of action in a complaint? Not that, because what it sounds to me is you're listing cases where it was presented in that form and decided in that form and came up on appeal in that form, but not necessarily that's the only way. I mean, obviously, Guava stands as an example of it not needing to.
Other than Guava, which, again, I suggest is an outlier, how else is someone going to have due process notice of what's being raised against them? For example,
I mean, but in this case, that's a difficult argument to make, because Mr. Rupp was, you know, he's the sole shareholder of the corporation. He was aware throughout. He signed the discovery responses when it was just Commonwealth.
He is not a party defendant. And to, for, an example in this case, the complaint in this case was for breach of lease. Thousands of breaches of lease cases against companies. Get a judgment against a company. And then you bring a motion to add someone as a party. Typically.
Well, not even to add them as a party in this case.
Yeah.
He's it wasn't never been added.
And as a judgment debtor. I was always taught that in order to bring a motion, it has to be based on a rule of civil procedure.
But if you look at the Guava case, and I think, respectfully, I think former Chief Judge Ed Cleary would disagree with you in terms of that being decided wrongly. But putting that to the side, it relied on a statute, which has since been repealed, but has been replaced by Minnesota Statute 302A.751. And under Subdivision 1C of that statute, it says that an action can be brought by a creditor, not just a shareholder, but by a creditor when, under sub 1, the claim of the creditor has been reduced to judgment and an execution thereon has been returned unsatisfied. That seems like that's satisfied here. So why couldn't we, like in Guava, why couldn't we rely, or the better yet, why can't the district court rely on that equitable remedy to pierce the corporate veil here?
Two answers to the question. One, I would have welcomed the opportunity to be able to argue 302A751 below. And secondly, I don't know in the record if there's been a writ of execution that was returned unsatisfied. I know.
Well, there's a judgment. There's a judgment by the district court.
Judgment and a writ of execution are two entirely separate things.
Right, but the parties entered into a settlement agreement. By the way, the parties entered into the settlement agreement in October, but according to Mr. Rupp's own testimony, he decided to wind down the business of Commonwealth in September of 2021. And a month later, the parties entered into a settlement agreement, and then in November 10th of 2021, the district court entered judgment against defendant.
I understand that, but Your Honor's question was dealing with a writ of execution, which is a term of art. And a writ of execution is where someone goes out, gets a writ from the court, attempts to collect an asset, the writ is returned unsatisfied. I don't believe there's any of that in the record.
I mean, I think there's a lot of appeal to your argument, perhaps in other contexts, but what concerns me is that I think the idea behind the alter ego theory is that Mr. Rupp was Commonwealth. I mean, that's the thrust of it. So when you talk about, no, he needed to be added as a party, why wouldn't we be elevating form over substance here when ultimately all of the due process that it seems like you're arguing for, whether it be Rule 12 or Rule 56, is answered by the district court in that order? I mean, if the district court didn't believe a valid claim for piercing the corporate veil existed, wouldn't the district court have addressed that in its order?
I see my time. Two answers to the question. First, I don't believe it is form over substance. There is no law that I am aware of that says a corporation loses its distinct character as an individual entity or person based on the number of shareholders it has, be it one, be it 100,000. The mere fact that it's a single shareholder, a single member in an LLC, it does not mean that because there's only one shareholder or member that ipso facto a judgment against the corporation automatically results in a judgment against the shareholder. I think there is substance there rather than form. And secondly, it can be inferred that perhaps the district court made that determination, but in so doing, there's eight factors under factor one. And siphoning, there's been a lot of talk about siphoning here as it relates to factor two. It sort of melds that portion of factor one into factor two. The district court spent three paragraphs talking about the eight factors. Victoria Elevators, unfortunately, there's no court, and I understand why, there's no opinion that says you need to have five, you need to have six. But it needs you have many of the factors. District court spent three paragraphs on it. So to the extent the district court was going to rule on, for example, a Rule 12 motion or a Rule 56 motion, had Mr. Rupp had the opportunity to bring it, each of those factors the district court presumably would have addressed. If we're going to rely on what the district court did now, it touched on maybe four of the eight.
If I may ask one more question.
Thank you.
My last question is, throughout your brief, you seem to argue that summary judgment standard should apply here, but you would agree that we review piercing the corporate veil under the abuse of discretion standard, right?
No.
Why not? I think the law is pretty clear that we review.
Well, I think if you look at the cases that were cited by the respondent were reviews after Rule 52 motions, were reviews after trial, which was clear error. I don't know of a case that was cited, that was a published decision from the state of Minnesota that says that's abuse of discretion, because all those cases procedurally, which is part of the problem here, procedurally came up either on a summary judgment motion or it came up after a trial and there was a motion for amended findings. That motion for amended findings was denied and it came up to this court.
How can we review under a summary judgment standard when a summary judgment motion was never brought?
You can't. That's why it needs to be remanded to the district court for the district court to take proceedings.
But my point is, how can you advocate for us to review under a summary judgment standard, which is what you do throughout your brief, when no summary judgment motion had ever been brought?
Well, the reason I argued for a summary judgment standard was because it is a more difficult standard on appeal. I mean, to be frank, but at the same time, which standard? Is it the standard after a trial? Is it a standard under Rule 52? If it's a standard under Rule 52, I still think the district court needs to be reversed and remanded. If it's under Rule 56, it needs to be reversed and remanded. This is not a motion under Rule 15, because then we would be asking whether or not it was proper to amend the complaint. That's not the issue here of whether it's proper to amend the complaint. The issue here is whether it's proper to just add someone as a debtor and enter judgment against them. And there's no rule of civil procedure that allows that in and of itself.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments and briefing. We will issue a decision in the statutory time frame. That concludes our oral argument calendar this morning. We are in recess.